Dr. Suji Tamar Mattis is the medical director at Liminal Medicine, a new North Bay business that uses evidence-based practices to heal emotional suffering through psychedelic medicine. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here and grateful.
First off, tell us about the history of psychedelic medicine, sort of define some terms that people may not understand, and how it's become an important treatment for those who are struggling with serious mental health issues and disorders.
So when psychedelics were first really discovered and being worked with, I should say actually by Western medicine, because of course psychedelics have been known for eons and eons and been used for eons by many cultures in both religious and healing rituals. But when it specifically LSD became a big and important molecule that people were looking at researching in the 60s, it was actually being used by psychiatrists and psychologists to start working with people to see if they could help people with depression or people with alcoholism or people with a lot of these other issues to heal. But one of the interesting things I think a lot of people don't know is that Bill W. was actually being treated. He came up with the idea of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12-step program while he was being treated with type of ergot psychedelic medicine in inpatient treatment in the 60s or late 50s. And in that, he saw a vision of all of these alcoholics supporting each other, like this long line of alcoholics supporting each other. And that's where he started Alcoholics Anonymous. He later actually went to, when LSD became a thing, he wanted to start treating people with LSD and got some really great results in the past for working with people with addiction, which eventually is what actually got him thrown out of AA as somebody who worked there. Really interesting stuff. You can find that in one of the autobiographies about him. So in the 60s, people were working with these psychedelics, mostly LSD at that point, also psilocybin and a few other things, but they were being used by therapists and psychiatrists. Unfortunately, at that time, they were also being used to try and cure homosexuality. Of course, it did not work, but there was a lot of damage that was done to the queer community in that time by people trying to cure them with psychedelics, which is, you know, kind of those dark past things of the history of psychedelic medicine. And then now, of course, we're in the psychedelic renaissance because everything became completely legal. It was pretty much stomped down. You couldn't even do research on it. And now we're in this new psychedelic renaissance where there's a lot of people doing research on psychedelic medicine. And so when we say psychedelic medicine, we really mean using psychedelics with therapy to help people heal from different psychological and psychiatric issues. There is a lot of research going on right now. There are some cities and states that have decriminalized certain psychedelics. Currently, the only completely legal psychedelic is ketamine. It is an off-label use of ketamine, which was invented to be an anesthetic. But right away when they invented ketamine, they knew that it was causing all this psychedelic experience. When I was in med school, we were told that people have, I can't remember. It was something like reentry phenomenon. So they'll come out of the anesthesia, like talking like all the stuff that they've seen. And it's just odd and bizarre. And you just ignore them. And eventually they calm down and it's fine. And so this reentry phenomenon is really the psychedelic phenomenon. And then if you just ignore it, people won't talk about it. So it was fine. They wanted to call ketamine a dream state anesthetic at first, but then they decided it wasn't scientific enough. So they came up with the term dissociative anesthetic, which is a little unfortunate because it's not dissociation like we think about in psychology or psychiatry. It just means that you get sort of pulled out of your body and you get a really good ability to sort of look back at who you are and where you are in your life and in relation to the universe, and sort of it's a really, actually that is a really healing property of it. So currently that's the only legal medication. MAPS is the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Science. They have been working tirelessly for the last 30 years to do research, most specifically on MDMA, and they have done all of the FDA trials that are required. And just a few months ago, they applied for medical use of MDMA to the FDA, to the DEA program, to see if we can get that through. And that would be using it specifically as a psychedelic medicine in clinics with a therapist. Mm. It's not going to be available. You can't just like write a prescription for it and like pick it up at the pharmacy. It would be, you have to go to a place where it's been, you know, it's allowed to be dispensed on site and work with a therapist in that space. I know that psilocybin is pretty close to being, and psilocybin is pretty close to being at that level as well. There's still some more research they're doing, but I think they're already in phase 3 trials with psilocybin at this point. I've lost track a little bit. They haven't applied yet, but they should be able to soon. The interesting thing with that is that back in the 80s, it was being used extremely successfully for therapy. And it's an extremely useful medicine for people with PTSD, also for couples therapy. Not so great for people with depression. It is, it's a relatively very safe drug. There were some very odd newspaper stories that came out that had complete misinformation about it. But on the whole, all the research that has been done by MAPS shows that it's a pretty safe medication. That being said, though, people who are taking certain medications shouldn't be using a lot of the psychedelics. Like the most of the psychedelics in the world work on the serotonin system. And if you're taking an SSRI, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, it will interfere with the action of a lot of these other psychedelics. Strangely enough, ketamine is one of the only ones that does not care about serotonin. So ketamine works in the glutamate system. So you can be taking whatever, however much Prozac or any of those medications, and it's not going to matter. You're still going to get a full psychedelic experience.
What drew you to this treatment? What was sort of the spark?
Right. So I, as a physician, I've only worked in underserved populations until recently. And before that, I've been an intersex activist since the early 90s, the 94, I think it was, when the intersex community, when Beau Laurent or Cheryl Chase at that point founded the whole intersex community, and we started doing activism. And this is a community that has a lot of medical trauma. It's pretty severe medical and ongoing medical trauma. And then I've worked with a lot of underserved populations. So I worked in the homeless clinic in Santa Rosa. I've worked in Indian Health in Santa Rosa. And I also started the transgender clinic at the Santa Rosa Community Health Centers back in, I think that was in 2009. And that's still running today. And all of these communities do have a very high level of trauma and PTSD from all these things that people have gone through, as well as like high level depression, especially working in the homeless clinic and seeing that so much of our psychiatric medicines don't really work that well. I just was really feeling frustrated. And then I started seeing all this information about this psychedelic, you know, renaissance, all these things were really helping. And I wanted to get more information. So I applied and was admitted to the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco to their program on psychedelic therapies and research. It's a 9-month certification program. And so I completed that in 2018 and went on to do more training at Polaris Insight Center in San Francisco. Their site is actually located in the Castro, and specifically in ketamine and ketamine-assisted work and the medical parts of that. And then I've started working here in 2021. So we've been open about 2.5 years here. We just underwent a big reorganization. And so we were Evolve Mind Wellness. There's a lot of reorganization that happened, and we're now Clinical Medicine.
So how do you determine who would benefit from such treatment?
So who benefits from specifically ketamine treatment? Ketamine has some really interesting properties. One is that it does work as a really rapid antidepressant, which is great. And it will work for SSRIs. They work for maybe 30% of the population. Ketamine works for more like 70 to 80% of the population.
Wow.
And you can get some reversal and, you know, at least some relief of your depression within, you know, 3 to 4 weeks. It's pretty rapid acting. It also works as a very rapid acting anti-suicidal ideation medicine. So people who have suicidal ideation who just want to kill themselves, that's all they can think of, is they will lose that desire pretty quickly. Hmm. Those for people who are severely in that situation and who are coming to us from maybe partial hospitalization or full hospitalization or even intensive outpatient treatment, we do 2 injections a week for 3 weeks, and that will break the suicidality, which is awesome. I'm a board certified family medicine doctor, so I can see young people. Our youngest patient was 14 so far. Mm. Mostly we get referrals from psychiatrists for the younger people. And those patients are sent over mostly for the severe suicidal ideation issues that they're having. That's all they can think about. And oftentimes they're in residential treatment because they just can't be left alone because they just want to kill themselves. Yeah. And this is an amazing treatment. Once again, in 3 weeks, you know, 2 to 3 weeks, we can actually break that suicidality with this treatment. And, you know, people just don't want to kill themselves anymore.
So what does that treatment look like?
That's the interesting thing. So for ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, you go through, you know, medical intake and the psychological intake and then, you know, another meeting with a psychologist, and then we do our first dose and our first journey or treatment appointment. These last 2.5 hours, one of the other great things about ketamine as a psychedelic is the psychedelic portion lasts somewhere between 20 to 40 minutes, depending on the person, maybe 50 minutes. And then the rest of the time, you're just coming back into your body and you're just feeling really open and your heart is open and you're really able to do a lot of therapy at that point as well. But it is a short acting psychedelic, which makes it really, really useful for this kind of work. So people come in, can't eat for 4 hours beforehand. We have recliners in every room. You sit with your therapist for a little bit and sort of just get grounded and ready. Sit back in the recliner. Everybody gets blankets because you will get cold with this when you're in this medicine. And a blindfold, and then we have some calming music playing. And all our rooms have a very calming feel to them. I or one of our other medical providers, so come in and we usually work by injection, and so we'll do an injection. And that will take you out to this very deep space. Well, it's also dose dependent. You know, we work people up. We don't want to push people out too far, because if you go out too far when you're not ready, you're just like going to sort of white out on all of that and not really remember enough. You have to be in that, just in the right space, so you're out there far enough and that you're able to bring more stuff back that you need to work on. And so we come in, we do the injection. I need a little booster, just depends on how people are doing. And the therapist sits with you the entire time. We never leave anyone alone in the medicine, so there's always somebody with you. They'll talk with you while you're out there. I'll come in if you need anything. And then as you start coming back into your body, because you're usually like totally out of your body or somewhere else. So you start coming back into your body, then you start wanting to talk, you start wanting to move. And as soon as you can see, relatively, your vision kind of comes back last. It's just that your vision's sort of everything moves. You're just going to not open your eyes until you're really back, or and then you can eat once you're completely back. And so the rest of that time is really spent talking with the therapist. One of the great effects of ketamine is that it can, and it does, decrease the activity of the fear and anxiety centers in the brain. So that really allows people, especially people with PTSD, to access some of these really traumatic episodes in their life and be able to examine them without that fight or flight sort of anxiety. Experience, that emotion, without the fight or flight. physical emotion to it, and then sort of repack those memories without that fight or flight issue, really allows people to resolve a lot of PTSD issues.
Wow.
And you can, yeah, it is very, very useful for that too.
That's amazing. That's amazing. So talk about some of the folks you work with at Liminal.
Yeah, we have a great, we have a really great crew here at Liminal. We've been together for, two of the therapists have been here 2 years, and the other therapist has been here since the beginning, and is one of our business partners. So Celeste has worked with pretty severely mentally ill patients. She's done crisis work. She's an LCSW. She did a lot of crisis work for one of the Kaisers, mental health crisis. And Moksha, who is an MFT, also has worked for Sonoma County and County Behavioral Systems, also has done my mental health crisis work as well. Also does private practice and is a somatic-based therapist. And then we have Shoshana, who is another MFT who has like really just solid skills working with people in altered states of consciousness. They actually all have really solid skills in working with people in altered states of consciousness. Mm. They're all amazing therapists. It's like a dream job. I get to work with these awesome people. And then my wife of 28 years, Anne, runs the company, really. She's like, does all the administrative work. And she does all of the making everything happen so that all we have to do is get in and do our part.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about a success story that's particularly impressive?
We had this patient who had this intense ongoing grief issue. She had lost her husband and somewhere between 2 and 4 years before she saw us. And she just was still grieving and just couldn't get over this loss. Mm-hmm. It was really hard for her. And she came in and she, in her first experience, in her first ketamine experience, most people can't talk during these, but she was able to talk through the whole thing. And she was like narrating what she was seeing. She's like, oh, you know, I see him. We'll say his name's George. I see George. And he's hugging me and he's telling me that it's okay. Mm. And that there's a place for me on the other side. He's got a place for me there. Oh, and my dog who also died, is also there. And he's got my dog there. And he's like, they're all ready for me when I'm going to come. And he still loves me. And she came out of that feeling so much better. Mm. A lot of resolution of that intense grief. And, you know, just a very solid feeling that when she dies, it's going to be okay. That was really pretty beautiful.
Wow. So do you get referrals from agencies, state and local agencies and organizations?
Mostly we get referrals from other therapists and from psychiatrists. Also, many people self-refer. The big issue with this therapy is that it's not covered by insurance and it's an off-label use of ketamine. But the bigger issue really is that if you are doing this work, you're sitting with the therapist for 2.5 hours. And then within that same week, you do another 1 hour integration session which is a little later, a couple days later, where you actually bring all that stuff that came up in your session, and you really integrate that into your daily reality. And that's really an important part of the treatment. So you're going to be 3.5 hours a week with a therapist. 6 weeks usually is what it takes.
Oh.
Most insurances, if you're lucky, will cover 1 hour a week of therapy. Mm. If you're unlucky, if you got Kaiser, they give 1 hour a month of therapy, which is kind of an odd and ridiculous concept. So that's the biggest issue why it's not covered. It's the amount of therapy that's happening. And because our current insurance industry does not feel that mental health is that important, it doesn't fund it, and we are in such a mess because of this. So yeah, there's no rhyme or reason to how they're funding mental health. I think that we can show that you have a quicker resolution of a lot of these issues and people do a lot better if you put this money in the beginning, actually in this one place. You'll see this also, like Medi-Cal doesn't cover intensive outpatient treatment either, which is a really excellent way of stabilizing people with psychiatric issues and is super valuable. And they don't cover that, even though we know that works too. So That's kind of the big issue here.
It is such a crisis of epic proportions, the lack of mental health services in this country. It's disgraceful. I work with asylum seekers, queer asylum seekers, and all of them suffer from PTSD. They've all had horrible experiences in their home countries, most of them, and of course, getting here and going through that process. And we work nonstop trying to find folks who could help them and funding, because it's expensive, and we understand why. You know, it's expensive to go to medical school, and folks can't, you know, take on.
To like get your degree in therapy and to get your certification process. And, you know, we all have to pay our bills, and, you can't work for free all the time.
Right.
So you can't really get therapists to, unless they're getting paid, to consistently do this, right? It's not going to work, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, it's the system is such a mess. I also, when I was running the trans clinic, we got the Tina Transgender Women's Support Group lost their meeting space, so we brought it to our clinic. And so once a month, they would come there. We had a meeting space there. I would block an hour of my time once a month in my clinic so that I could go and, like, hang out there. My Spanish isn't very good, so we always have a translator as well. And just answer questions and just, like, talk with people. And I can tell you that is also a community that has suffered a lot of trauma. And really could use so much more support.
Of course. Tell us how folks can find out more about Liminal.
You can find us on the web at www.liminal-med.com. Or you can call us at 707-861-0807.
Perfect, perfect. Doctor, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. Please come back. Thank you for the amazing work you do. And enjoy your week.
You too. Thank you so much.
Joining us now is Jay Walsh, who is one of the volunteer organizers for Out in Tech, who is working on building a North Bay chapter. We welcome you to Outbeat Radio, Jay.
Thank you. What a pleasure to be here. Thanks for bringing me on.
Great. We're really excited. Out in Tech is doing something here in the North Bay. Give us a brief history of the organization and talk about its goals.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Out in Tech's been around for quite a long time, and bringing together, like, at a high level across the planet, really, helping folks network and connect who LGBTQ plus folks who are in the tech community. Or they aspire to be in the tech community. So maybe they're in school and they're like, or maybe they're not in school and they're like, can I work in this field? Like, I want to have a great job and do something important. And so it exists to provide those opportunities, but also to connect folks who are in there right now, where it can sometimes be, maybe you work in the world of tech and you're the only, you know, LGBT queer person, whether you're open or identifying yourself or not. And it can be lonely, it can be tough. Not every tech company is sort of ultra forward and like, embracing folks. So that's one of the reasons they exist. And it's really, it's an international effort that is very virtual. And of course, it got even more virtual during the pandemic, that is really driven by, you know, getting people to sign up. And then we have a really big, thriving Slack community of we've got about 50,000 members.
Wow. Around the world,
but it's a huge group, right? And that Slack community is just kind of the, where everybody shows up. Hi, you know, nice to be here. Here's who I am. We have a nice structured way to have folks introduce themselves. And then they can find groups that are geographically significant or significant to their interests. There's an over 40 group. There's a, you know, whether you're a UX designer or whether you're kind of working in marketing, you know, there are different places where folks can connect and chat, or just a general side. And then across the org, we also host both virtual and in-person events where people can get together and meet. And a lot of these events are wonderful. They're hosted by tech companies. And so we can get together and in many cases just socialize, network, often explore topics relevant to the LGBTQ experience in the tech space, things like building ERGs, employee resource groups, or improving visibility, or leadership or training, or how do we work harder to open the doors to let more folks into the space? Because it's not, work's not done, right? There's still a huge amount of work to do to help, smash those barriers and increase diversity within tech. So those are the key parts. And then there's a big mission focus on really mentorship and leveling up folks who are saying, I want to work in tech. And I hear there's good jobs there. It's just, you know, there's work I want to do. And we want to make it easier to help those folks find that mentorship, but also to think about ways to get through the door and start it out. Because you, whatever you're doing, there's a path for you and there's work to be done. So yeah, that's kind of out in tech in a nutshell. It's in person, it's virtual, and it's an amazing community. I worked in tech for over 20 years, and you know, coming in contact with them has been an extraordinary pleasure, because it feels like it's sort of my tribe within my tribe, you know, of people within this space. So I love it.
Nice. When did you start working with the group?
So I probably over a year ago now, about a year and a half or so ago, and I work at a distributed tech company called Automattic, which is really well known for being one of the founder of Automattic was one of the co-founders of WordPress. WordPress is a pretty popular part of the internet, or powers almost half of the internet.
Oh, I use it a lot.
Yeah, a lot of folks within the community absolutely maybe started their first site on WordPress and continue to build it. So but the business side of Automattic, or you know, where we work, they're a big sponsor of Out in Tech. So I was able to, amongst other things, they contribute people and staff and resources to help Out in Tech build WordPress sites, high functioning WordPress sites for LGBTQ orgs, usually activist orgs in parts of the world where it's very dangerous to do that, or very difficult to do that work, particularly North Africa and the Middle East. Yeah. So one of the amazing things is called the Digital Core, and volunteers from Out in Tech from around the world in person, they'll meet and they'll sort of do a kind of one day hackathon, and they'll build these sites, and not just give them a site, but like give them instruction manuals and give them, you know, marketing tools and everything they need, or they'll update a previous site. And so Automattic sponsors that, and it's their WordPress sites, and they give them 5 years to really let these sites grow and thrive. And it's incredibly riveting and a really exciting thing to be able to see happen. So that's what got me in contact with that. Oh, I love this. I want to do more to work with this group.
That's incredible. That's incredible. That kind of mentorship and philanthropy almost, right?
Yeah. And I think it's a supporting for any tech company supporting Out in Tech or similar orgs. It's a really important thing to make public, make visible, right? So that people can say, oh, I could work there. That's a culture there that's going to accept that. And I'm really lucky to work in a company that really embraces neurodivergence, it embraces the LGBTQ community, the trans community. It's just, and it's distributed and it's multicultural. So it really represents that. So it kind of is a really nice mesh within those organizations. But anyway, many other tech companies work with Out in Tech and partner, and they all kind of want to support that. They want to help that community feel a greater sense of belonging and really bring them in and help them find good work.
Yeah. And tech is one of those fields where it's very diverse, culturally, gender wise.
Tremendously, but not diverse enough. Right. So I think what's really exciting in many ways is that although tech is such a big term, and personally, I think about tech and I think knowledge sector, they're very similar. Like it's not just folks who work at desks, but it's folks who, like, I'm not a coder. I'm not a high tech kind of person. I work in the marketing and PR side of tech and have for a long time. So I think it's a bigger definition of a space of people who are not just necessarily software engineers, but like there's a large group of folks who work around that. Or then maybe they work in healthcare and they work in tech. You know, like a lot of people work in tech and maybe they don't know it.
Oh, right.
They don't really think about
it,
but it's it's much bigger than it might look. So it's really important, I think, for us to consider that the tech products we use are always works in progress. And many times the tools are, you know, they're repressing the voices of diverse and marginalized communities. And we need to be part of that so that we can raise our hand and say, this is broken. Hold on, you know, like, so I think having that population in there, particularly LGBTQ population, but they also tend to be folks from, you know, non-white, different class experiences, different parts of the world, that it comes with it. So you bring in this community and you get all of this diversity and we make the products better. I think we have to. That's our mission, is to say, whoops, you're not thinking about this population.
Right.
Let's rebuild this thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Would you say there's a higher percentage of queer folks working in tech compared to most other industries?
I would say that's certainly my experience, especially given there's a welcomeness to it. Like that hasn't always been the way. We should be really clear. I think for many years, it was very much a business focus, you know, technology focus. And I think it's really shifted over the past, I don't know, maybe the past decade or so. A lot of tech companies said, oh, wait a minute, these are part of our customers. These are part of the people we want to serve.
Yeah.
And we shouldn't, as an engineer or whatever, whoever you might be, you can't think of all people as being the same. They have very specific distinctions and differences. So yeah, within tech, I'd say it's, I wouldn't say disproportionate, but yeah, a lot of folks, a lot of queer folks working in that space. I think that that's getting even more so the case, because especially where I think younger people who are in school and thinking, where do I want to work? Often they think about what are the most maybe they're a young trans person and they're like, I need to work in a place that's going to be inclusive. It talks about this. I don't want to go in there. And like, so I think they're drawn into that space because we're a little more open to doing that. And yet some are, you know, some cultures are very different. But so we that's really part of the important work on tech is to kind of hold the businesses accountable, hold our partners accountable to make the space open, smash those doors down and like let people feel comfortable and safe in their job.
Yes, yes. Do you want to give a shout out to some of the big companies that support Out in Tech?
Gosh, there have been so many great, some recent sponsors of some events. LinkedIn was a big sponsor of an event in San Francisco recently. So there's a big, to be clear, there's a big group of folks, not surprisingly, in the Bay Area. So LinkedIn hosted a wonderful event talking about ERGs or employee resource groups and sort of helping increase visibility. I already mentioned Automattic is a big sponsor and makes that, those things possible. We were at an event not too long ago, or Yahoo and Culver City, that at their campus they were hosting Out in Tech, and you know, that's really important to them, right? It gives them a chance to say, we're having an event, so their teams and their employees can come and take part in this event, but also other people can come in, get to know that company, and you know, learn about their values. So, lots of amazing partners. We're always looking for more, though. We're always looking to expand that, and that's part of the challenge in the North Bay, isn't it? Because there are some tech companies here, but the concentration is mostly in the South Bay.
Yeah.
East Bay, downtown San Francisco. I think their workforces are here. Like a lot of them work up here, particularly during the pandemic. And there are some amazing tech companies here. So part of what I think is like shifting that narrative around, oh no, this is just recreational wine country. No, it's actually also thriving in terms of business and growth. So there's a lot on up here.
There certainly is. So how many sort of participants do you have in the East Bay chapter?
Well, so if we mostly count based on the whole Bay Area chapter or the whole Bay Area experience, and we have about 5,000 to 6,000 ish members just in that space alone, which yeah, it's pretty big. It, again, pretty not surprisingly, pretty big out of our overall kind of mailing list. And so we tend to, and I think this is somewhat intentional and good. We invite folks from that group to understand and learn about the events happening in the, whether it's the South Bay or the East Bay, or, you know, even towards Sacramento and towards the Solano County in that direction, or the North Bay, because a lot of them want to come up. You know, they want to do stuff up here, or they want to expand and think about where they live. It's also about talking to the folks who are here, but it's also about saying, hey, you know, come on up. You know, it's an invitation. Come and hang out with us. Because maybe they don't think about those areas as having, you know, approachable environments where they could get together and meet. So it's a kind of a little bit of both. I believe there are quite a few folks up here who are either current members or prospective folks who may not know about this. So we can get the word out.
Yeah. So how often do you have meetings in the East Bay and the South Bay?
So events happen definitely. I would say on our mailing list, we'll see in the local area events at least once a month, sometimes a little more often than that, depending on, you know, across different parts of the area. We try to host an event, though, in each of our areas, at least two or three events a year. And we kind of have a model that's not too focused, although we sometimes have regular events. But we tend to focus a little more on sort of sporadic, like, hey, we're going to be here. Let's connect and meet. And we pick different locations and different environments to host at. So usually we like to be hosted by a tech company or somebody in that space. But sometimes, like up here, we're going to choose other places that are fun to get together and hang out at.
Yeah, nice. So you kind of touch on it, but talk more about the decision to start a North Bay chapter.
Yeah, and so the local organizers in the San Francisco chapter in the Bay Area had sort of known that there was a kind of spot up here that wasn't really, there's people up there. I'm like, yeah, there's people there. So I think I was just maybe good timing, and I was like, I'm here, you know, raise my hand. I'm working up here, and I want to help bring in more people and find other people to help bring in more people and have events. And so some of that, and that's, I think, I'm excited to be able to do that. I just know there's a big community up here, and a lot of people come here for recreation and to relax. But also, I think as soon as they do that, they're like, oh, I could live up here. Could I work here? You know, could I make this happen? And so as an openly gay person living and working in this industry up here, I actually have a lot of my company colleagues also live in this area, but like surprisingly difficult to kind of connect with other people who work in the industry that I work in or the space. So that was kind of that's the genesis of expanding these chapters all over the world at the local level, not just at the metropolitan level, because that's where we live. So I'd like to hang out and build relationships with people who live in the area. And also to be of service, to maybe provide some mentorship and guidance to younger people up here who are coming out or you know, struggling with struggling to find out what to do from mm-hmm. a career standpoint. I know growing up I grew up in rural Canada, really hard to find mentors that like, you should do this or you should follow in this direction. So I think create spaces where people can say, oh yeah, okay, cool. There's a pathway for that. That person looks like me or kind of is like me. And I could do that. I like making video games. I like hacking on stuff. Like maybe I should go in this direction. So mm-hmm. I'm really hopeful that we can bring some folks together to show that pathway. Nice. And to get folks excited to do that transition. Even if you've been working for years, I'm like, I kind of want to get in on that. Yeah. There's a lot of opportunities to work at home. There's a lot of opportunity. It's a very tough market right now, but it's still growing. There's always lots of things happening. So there's lots of ways to get into it.
Does Out in Tech work with universities and colleges and
mm-hmm. increasingly? Yes. We're kind of at the beginning stages of that. We have a well built mentorship program that rotates, I think, twice a year, two cohorts a year, where we invite both prospective mentors and prospective mentees from all over the world to sort of express interest and tell us what they'd like to learn and do. And then they work on a project. So the mentees come in and work with a mentor. They work on a project over about 6 to 8 weeks, I think, and they get some time. So there's sort of a project approach to making that happen. And often they're students. They're maybe in the early stages of college, or they're thinking about going to college. Mm-hmm. It'd be a variety of things. And they kind of come out of that program with a really cool completed project, help from a mentor, a team of other mentors. And then we kind of shop them around, and we want to connect them to job opportunities and make sure that employers see them and can kind of, hey, come to us, have your internship here, or whatever that case might be. So that's one approach. But I think we're also exploring ways to connect with colleges and college systems and ways to provide good access to mentors that can help them find that path and see, oh, yeah, I could kind of make that happen. But at the same time, membership is open to everybody. So we want folks to just get involved and connect with people online.
Nice.
Or in person.
Mm-hmm. Very good. That's great. So tell us about the event you have planned for April 10th.
Yeah, so we have our first kickoff event planned for in San Rafael. It's going to be April 10th. We've been invited by the folks at Pond Farm Brewing in San Rafael, which is a wonderful, really nice spot, just a little off the down. It's in downtown San Rafael on 4th Street. And we're going to get together there. We encourage folks. We really want them to register. So we'll have a link, I hope, somewhere that they can find. Just to register so we can see how many people are going to be showing up. April 10th, about 4:30, I think. And it'll be our first time. So rather than try to be really, organized, we're like, hey, just get together. Let's start talking. You know, what would be of use? What could we do that might be more helpful? And we're working on our next gathering, our next social event in Santa Rosa, location TBD, but I think probably that'll happen late May and June. Excited about that. And I think it'll be interesting to see the difference, right, between who the folks, I think we'll have people who will want to go to both, because it's fun to meet your peers in different parts. And we should definitely focus on Napa down the road. We want to be able to be visible there as well. So I think there's all kinds of opportunities. And what, I don't know, future events, maybe educational opportunities, working with some of the other amazing local organizations. We're starting to build some conversations with them to see how could we help? Like, what could we do? How could we connect and be of service?
Very good. So what will be happening at the event?
You know what? It's like most socials. I think it'll be open-ended. Come and see us. We'll be here in the corner. Make sure we want to make sure people are signed up and that they can find out and be a part of Out in the Tech. That's our kind of big mission. And then we want to talk about what we do and what they can, if they're not familiar, what they can gain from that, what they can learn, how they can network, how they can build skills. We're really, I think, a very porous community that wants to help each other in a way that can be kind of difficult for an LGBTQ person. Sometimes you may not have that type of a you have a different type of professional network, or, you know, we want to be able to sort of challenge some of that and say, hey, I know someone over here. I'm going to introduce you to them, or, you know, let me see if I know somebody who can help you do that. So we have this powerful network and this amazing connectivity. Let's use it. Find new roles, you know, meet new people, get to know folks in an industry you might be curious about. So we can do that in person. We can just, you know, we can shoot the breeze and learn about each other. I think that's the first step. Yeah.
Nice.
Just get together and then plan some more things of this nature.
Nice. So how can folks learn about the event and RSVP?
Yeah. So if they go to outintech.com, they will see a link to events, and they should see this event listed as one of the top first events because it's coming up. I believe, yeah, outintech.com. And if they click on events, view all, they should see a little bit of a set of mixers. You'll actually see right away how many. They're all over the world. And they will find our mixer in the North Bay, a little bit down the way. They'll see that link there, and they can register. It's totally free. That's how they can find out. And then the way they'll sort of semi sign up, and we'll talk a little bit more when they come and get involved and join us on this community. We have a local Slack channel for the North Bay that we can kind of share events and goings on, and I'd love to grow that as well. And yeah, just to find ways to connect. And some people may not want to connect in person. That's cool. We're looking at some virtual events as well, that support the Bay Area. And I think, cause a lot of people are like, I'd like to know some people in South Bay. I'd like to know some people in Oakland. You know, how do I get to know more folks? So we get it. You know, you want to expand your horizons. So we want to do some of that as well.
Nice. Other social media, Facebook or.
Out in Tech is on, certainly you'll find if you hit to outintech.com, and the simplest thing you could do is probably just go to outintech.com, join, and you'll sort of see those events and you'll see these things within the space.
Yeah.
Definitely encourage folks to do that. Again, there's no fee, there's no cost. You're not going to get spammed with things you don't want. It's really about getting you into this space to have this conversation. You'll find us on Facebook, but really we use Slack and LinkedIn, but we particularly use Slack as a really great space to connect and converse and organize.
Yeah.
And it'll be well worth your time, especially a lot of folks work and use Slack as a work tool. So this is kind of like, for me, it's like, I can jump over to the Slack server, go, I can relax for a second, meet with my colleagues and my peers.
Nice.
I love it though. It's such a great community.
Yeah. So do you want to talk about your experience, you know, working in tech, you touched on, but also coming out as queer at your job?
Yeah, no, that's a great topic. And it's funny, I originally said from Canada, and I've worked in the PR and communications field for a long time, but I finished graduating and kind of started working around 2000, right? So gosh, geez, that's 24 years ago. That's hard to wrap my head around. But I'm kind of fortunate. I feel like getting able to shoulder a generation where we didn't really talk so much about, there was no, you know, I worked in the public sector in Canada and worked for a big media company in Canada, and we didn't really talk about it, you know? So it was just interesting. Like you could be, and I worked in Toronto, which is like, that's the big city in Canada. And I lived in the gay village in Toronto, but it's sort of hard to describe, but it was just like, we didn't really, you know, there were no ERGs, there were no resource groups. There was just like, you know, nobody really talked about it. But it was also, it felt safe and good, but stressful, right? Really, you know, still kind of hard. And it was almost like, well, you'll do all that social stuff after hours. You know, you go, you don't take that to work. You don't talk
right,
about that.
Right.
And then in 2008, an opportunity to move to San Francisco and work. I worked for Wikipedia in the very early days, the nonprofit Wikipedia that was just moving to the Bay Area. And it changed a lot of things. You're in San Francisco, but also I think that was really the beginning in the tech space of being more open in identifying the importance of involving LGBTQ plus people, but also people of different backgrounds and immigrants. And I think getting to see that happen then, and I remember stuff like watching the Pride events in the city, or coming and seeing, you know, Facebook marching and Google marching. And, you know, that's kind of cool, sure. But like, really, I wanted to see more about visibility and more about leadership. Like, it's one thing to see support. Allyship,
right, good. Right.
Allyship's important. But like, what's really happening in that space? And so I think working in tech from around 2008 or so and to today, it sort of moved through this phase of like kind of corporate acknowledgement towards, okay, yeah, you should be organized and, you know, doing stuff to create communities and conversations within. And then you sort of see the corporations go, oh, also we want to hire LGBTQ people because you're creative and brilliant and hardworking. And so, okay, well, that's good. But there's a kind of a like give and take, right? Like, I think we also need to ask for good and important conversations about quality and about safety and about you know, the way the products are being built. So we try to hold those tech companies accountable. And that's been, once we started doing more of that, and now I feel like queer people in tech, when there's this sort of ability to bind and to work together, mm-hmm. we can hold the product developers accountable. We can hold leadership accountable to say, hey, this is not good for the, you know, queer people in this environment or what have you. So that sort of transition towards giving us a little more sense of voice and power and being able to organize a little more effectively. And so some companies are way ahead on that, but others are, you know, I think there's still a lot of work to be done. So we can go from just being socially aware to, hey, let's actively hire people from this community. Let's not just talk about it. Let's really do it. And also, let's build our products with the mindfulness and support the communities that use our products to make sure that queer people are represented and heard. I feel like we have that responsibility. That's, so it's sort of gone from visibility to like responsibility.
Yeah. And a little activism thrown in.
Absolutely. And yeah, there's some allyship. I think a lot of what we do is allyship, but I think some of it we have to be unashamedly just open and direct. But I also want to say, like, it's not easy. Well, we're still at a time when a lot of folks are still in like 2005 and they don't want to necessarily openly identify. I have mixed feelings about that. I think obviously sometimes you can't, like, you have to be mindful of that. But I think calling ourselves out in tech is not an accident. It's about visibility and ownership. So I feel like we're moving towards a time when it really means something to just sort of operate in the open. And to be, we're not making it boring. You know, we're not making it uninteresting. I think we're making
it
about respect.
Nice.
Yeah.
Jay, well, thank you so much. We had a great conversation. Please keep me in touch. I've got your information on gaysonoma.com. So
yeah, super.
You can RSVP from there and link from there. Thank you for joining us again, and best wishes for a successful event. I might even sneak in.
Come on down. Like, everybody's welcome. If you don't work in tech, I'm pretty confident you're involved in it. You use it, you're part of it, you pay for it, whatever.
Really?
Yeah. Or you know people who might want it. And again, I think as many folks as interested, and I want to also say a special invitation to folks who may have worked in tech and said, well, I don't work there now. And you're still relevant. We still want to see you, hear your voice. A lot of folks, I'll tell you, it's hard to find mentors. It's hard to find people who have stories about working in anything in the industry. And it's super valuable to have your experience. Even if you consider yourself fully retired, come on out, meet some people.
Yep. And think about the next generation of queer tech.
Support the next. Who is going to?
Yeah.
I promise you, only
us.
Not
you.
It's on us to create a sense of safety, support, and excitement about working in the industries we do. No one's going to do it. Except for the people who are there before or are there right now. So
you're a good spokesperson, Jay.
I love what this is about. It's great fun. You know, we're here to have fun and also to connect and just have a good time as well.
Very good.
Thank you, Gary.
Good.
Nice to hear from you.
Great. Give us the website one more time.
Right. So easiest thing, head to outintech.com, outintech.com, and sign up under the join, but also you can find us at outintech.com/events. You'll see the event down below there, and come out and support your local community.
Very good. Thanks again, Jay.
Thank you. Have a great weekend, and I hope you have a nice sunny maybe we'll have a nice sunny Easter weekend.
Easter, yeah, it looks like.
I feel it today. I guess sun beating in on me. I was just talking to someone in London, and it's like, oh, it's not, we just wish we could get some sun. I was like, well, I hate to tell you, but I'm closing my blinds. It's too sunny in here. It's crazy, man. You're crazy. Anyway.
Very good.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jay.
Thanks, Jerry. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.